Okay, so y'all ready to get started?
Yeah.
So here we are. This is the second lecture in chapter one, right?
Yes.
And the last thing I was talking about is entrepreneurial ability. We talked about who the entrepreneur is and some characteristics of the entrepreneur. And I think the last thing I was talking about was concept of whatever that is you keep, you lose, or whatever it is you lose, you keep. Remember that? We talked about that. Like, what two things do you all want because you're here?
Money and time.
So to get more money and time in the future, what are you giving away?
Money and time.
You give away time, you give away money to get more money and time in the future. You know, there's another law that kind of dovetails with that, and that the law says that whatever you have, you'll be given more. And whatever you don't have, then that thing that you don't have will be taken away. That's another law that the entrepreneurs understand.
How's that?
Yeah, how's that? That sounds like another one of these riddles, right? Whatever you have, you'll be given more, and whatever you don't have, then that thing that you don't have will be taken away. Now, what I'm going to explain to you is one of the keys to wealth building. And it's quite simple, and you already know this. Like everything else, I often explain to you things that you already know, but you don't know you know it, right? Whatever you have, you'll be given more. You have $1,000. You take $1,000 and you put it in a savings account. Now, what's the bank going to do? Pay you interest. They're going to give you more. Now, why is the bank going to give you money? Because you had money. Right? Well, you had money. You had money, so what were you given?
More money.
Now, let's suppose that you want to buy a new car. The price of the new car is $20,000. Now, if you had $20,000, you could simply go buy that car for $20,000. But you don't have $20,000. So you finance the car over 3 to 5 years. And because you're paying interest on that loan, that $20,000 car ends up costing you $25,000. Now, why did you pay $5,000 more? Why did you pay $25,000 for the car instead of $20,000? Because you did not have. Now, what did you not have?
Money.
So, what was taken away from you?
Money.
See how that works? Now you get it. See, entrepreneurs, they understand there are certain laws, and the key to wealth building, because really, you know, that's what the entrepreneur is all about. I mean, the entrepreneur is into wealth building. You see, and they know there are certain, you know, laws involved. See, another thing the entrepreneurs know is that if you got your mind set on making money, you'll be broke all your life. See, entrepreneurs do not have their mind on making money. Now, what's wrong with making money? I mean, we're talking about an entrepreneur now. We're talking about a business. Or I might say, you know, what's wrong with making a high income? No. Taxes. Taxes. You're taxed on your income. You're taxing your income. You're taxing capital gains. You're taxed, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of taxes involved here. You see, entrepreneurs want to make as less money as possible. A big part of that is because of tax reasons. Now, what do they want to make a lot of?
Business.
Well, in essence, you're right. Business in sense of assets. See, there's a difference between money and assets. See, you don't pay taxes on your assets. I mean, you may own rental property and pay personal property tax, and there's some taxes involved, but it's not that rent that you earn is unearned income, and according to our tax laws, those taxes are a lot less than earned income, like on a wage. Plus, there are lots of ways to not pay any taxes on that in terms of deductions that you have. If you make money in a paycheck, there's no chance of you sheltering that money. But if you make money like earning rent in rental property, then there are ways to shelter that money so you not pay taxes on it. You see, entrepreneurs do everything they can to build up their assets while keeping their income low. Now, what do broke people got their mind on? Making money. That's why people go into debt for buying an expensive house sometime and cars and things like that, because they got their mind on simply making money, but they don't have any sense of building up assets. If you buy a house for $200,000, but you only put $20,000 down, that whole house is not an asset for you, right? I mean, maybe part of it is. Of course, in today's market, a lot of people have a negative asset. They owe more on their house than what the house is worth in the market. So, see, just having a, I mean, having a more. In fact, do you know what the word mortgage means? I mean, the root definition of mortgage is being in debt for life. Interesting, isn't it? So, if you want to be an entrepreneur and you want to build up wealth, you got to get your mind off of simply making money and rather building assets. Warren Buffett, who Warren Buffett is? He's one of the wealthiest men on earth. And by the way, he made all his billions, not millions, but billions, mostly in the stock market. He's worth billions of dollars. You know what his taxable income is? $100,000 a year. Yeah, that's what his income is, $100,000 a year. One of the wealthiest men on earth. Because he can't stand making income. He can't stand paying taxes on that income. Yeah.
For example, like say if you're a realtor and you sell houses, you made $10,000 from selling this house. You go buy.
No, what do you mean? You mean profit?
Yeah, profit.
You mean you bought it for one price and sold it for another?
Yeah, you bought it for a price and then you sold it and made $10,000.
Yeah, okay.
And say if you went out to a jewelry store and bought a $10,000 diamond, that diamond would be an asset at that point and it can't be taxed, right? But you're still going to be taxed on the profit that you made.
Yeah, you're taxed. Well, the tax laws are very, it's hard for me to answer that because our tax laws are so complicated and lengthy that no human on earth really understands them all. And I'm certainly not an expert, but if we're one of the few countries in the world we may be one of the only countries in the world that actually has a capital gains tax to begin with. So if you buy something for one price and sell it for a higher price, then you do owe taxes on that gain, and the percentage that you owe is based on what the capital gains tax is, and it's not an income tax; it's a capital gains tax. Now, in some cases, you may be able to take that money and do something else with it. Like you mentioned the diamond. Well, I don't know if that would qualify, but you could do something else with it and then not pay taxes on the $10,000. Like you might take it and put it into another piece of real estate or something like that. But now these tax laws are strictly American laws, and they change frequently. So, I can't be specific on that. But I mean, there are ways that...
And then transfer it over to an asset without being taxed.
Yeah. It depends what that asset is,
right.
But yeah, there's all kinds of ways to do it. So But the point is, now, you see, if you like take Warren Buffett for example, I mean, if you had the house of your dreams, maybe even two houses and the cars of your dreams, and you had lots of clothes, but you know, furniture and all that, but all that was paid for. See, all that's paid for. I mean, you don't need a high income to live well. See what I mean? I mean, people that really need a high income are people that need lots of money to pay a high mortgage and pay for their car loans and pay their credit card loans. And so, I mean, you know, all that takes a high income. But I mean, if you've got everything paid for and you've got everything that you want, then it really doesn't take a whole high income. Now, Warren Buffett's an unusual guy. I mean, he drives used cars. His favorite vehicle is like a 5-6-year-old Ford truck, and he lives in the same house that he lived in when he got started, you know, 35-40 years ago. He hasn't moved. He lives in the same house, same, you know, middle class neighborhood. Never buys jewelry. Never buys fancy clothes. Drinks a lot of cherry cokes and never buys expensive wines or things like that. I mean, you know, he's sort of an extreme case, you know. And by the way, he's never bought a computer either. He doesn't know the first thing about computers. He does everything by hand still. You know, he doesn't. His total staff can fit in a room no larger than this room, and he's got no more than 3 or 4 employees. Right, that's interesting, isn't it? And yet he's one of the wealthiest men on earth. So, but the point I'm making here is the attitude. You know, well, two things really: attitude and awareness and knowledge. See, if you've got the right attitude and you've got the right knowledge, then you can be wealthy someday. But if you do what everyone else is doing, I mean, if you just look around you and kind of do what, you know, other people are doing, then you'll probably end up what they are, and most people end up broke. See, you got to be different. See, entrepreneurs are different people. They're people that swim against the current. You know, they're people that, you know, don't do what most people do. Now, before I leave this entrepreneur subject, if you were to ask me, where would I go to really learn how entrepreneurs think? You know, who could teach me to be wealthy someday? In my opinion, the best teacher in America and maybe in the world is a guy named Robert Kiyosaki. In Google, just type in Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That was his first book. He's written several books. In fact, I was just listening to one on the way here in my truck. But just put in Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and you know, and he'll come up. But Robert Kiyosaki has got several books, and he is, I mean, he's just got so much insight, and he's a tremendous, tremendous teacher. All his books have been in the top, you know, best-selling lists for years and years. Anyway, I just thought I'd give you that tip. I mean, I can get you started, but you know, Robert Kiyosaki can really get into the details. By the way, you know, I mean, it takes time to read books, and so I listen to more books than I read. I have all of Robert Kiyosaki's books on tape. And what I do most of the time when I come to, like what I did today, coming to class, I was listening to one of his books, you know, in my truck. And I get a lot done by, you know, listening to books. I buy, well, there's several places you can go, lots of places you can go to buy books on tape. But it's a tremendous way to, you know, to get an education. Okay, I mean, personally, I have a hard time just carving out time to sit down for a couple hours and read a book. But I can listen, you know, when I'm walking, and I can listen to, you know, it's like these MP3 lecture tapes. You know, you can listen to them in the car, and you can listen to them when you're working out and taking walks and things like that. All right, well, let's move on here. What is income called from resources? Now, the economic problem is that we live in a world of scarce resources, right? And yet people have unlimited wants. So how do we meet their needs in this world of scarcity? Now, we live in a world of scarce resources. Now, what are the... First of all, what does scarce mean? Scarce means there's not enough to go around for everyone who wants it for free. That's what scarce means. There's not enough for everyone at a zero price. Now, if there's not enough for everyone at a zero price, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? Prices. In a free market, we rely on the price mechanism. All right, so we live in a world of scarce resource. Now, what are the four resources that we just talked about? Land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship, right? Now, your author goes into, after talking about these four resources, he says, now, each of these resources earn income. And we in economics give this income names. And so that's what this slide simply describes. Remember, a lot of the what we do in the first four chapters is just vocabulary, right? And so we say that land receives income that we call rent. Labor receives income that we call wages. See, when you have a job, what are you essentially doing? You are selling what? Your labor. In fact, you know, Karl Marx, the founder of Marxism where communism stemmed from, but you know, he divided the world into two groups. He said there are proletariats and bourgeoisie. And the bourgeoisie are the owners of the means of production, and the proletariats are the ones who have nothing to sell but their labor. They don't have things to sell like the bourgeoisie, so they have to sell their labor because everyone has 24 hours in a day. So anyway, that's what the income that labor receives we call wages. The income that capital receives is called interest. And the income that entrepreneurs receive is called profit. Profit is the difference between total revenue and total cost. Okay? Anyway, that's just definition. Not much we can do with this except know the definition. Okay, what is rent? I got ahead of myself here. What are wages? What is interest? And profit. How is profit calculated? Total revenue from sales minus the total cost of resources employed by the entrepreneur. Now, remember I said that vocabulary is a big part of what we're doing here, and that sometime we define things that you may be familiar with, that we define them differently in economics. Well, this is one of those examples. There is a difference between the terms cost and price. Now, I may even go into a store and I might say, well, how much does this thing cost? Because that's just the way people talk. But technically, that's incorrect. See, cost in economics is a business term. Cost is what a business owner pays to produce something. That's, you know, business owners have costs, material costs, labor costs, things like that. Price is a consumer term. Price is what you and I pay for something at the store. So profit is on an item would be the difference between the price and the cost. See what I mean? Now, profit is defined in a business sense as total revenue minus total cost. Now, what is total revenue? Well, revenue is simply money in. Money in is revenue. Price times quantity is revenue. Profit is total revenue minus total cost. How much it costs us to make this thing, how much we're going to sell it for. That's total revenue. Total revenue minus total cost is profit. Unless total revenue is less than total cost, and then that would be a loss. Anyway, that's a fairly straightforward definition. Now, what is a market? A market. A set of arrangements through which buyers and sellers carry out exchange at mutually agreeable terms. And I talked about this earlier. And I explained to you that in economics, if there's not a market transaction, then we're not interested, right? Remember last time I explained to you how if we doubled the birth rate of cows in this country, would that increase the supply of cows? Well, you can't say yes or no. Now here's something else that y'all learn about economics. I ask you a question. Without even thinking about it, instinctively, you should respond, well, that all depends. Now, that's not true all the time, because there are absolutes. But most of the time in economics, if I ask you a question, the answer is, that all depends. Like in this case here, if we doubled the birth rate of cows, would the supply of cows increase? Well, that all depends. If this, then that. But if that, then this. Now, remember last time I talked about how economics was a way of thinking more than anything? It's a thought process. Well, to dovetail along with that idea of it being a thought process, it's also, there are certain patterns of thinking. What's the difference between a person who is highly successful and a person who is a failure? Well, there are success patterns and there are failure patterns. As humans, it's so easy for us to slip into patterns. We get used to doing certain things a certain way, and we kind of slip into these patterns, and we tend to do what's comfortable to us. We tend to do those things that are all already familiar to us. So it's easy for all of us to get into these patterns. Now, economics requires a certain thought pattern. I ask you a question. You say, well, don't forget the well on that. Well, that all depends. If this, then that. But if that, then this. Now, in this case, if we double the birth rate of cows, would the supply of cows increase? Well, that all depends. If those extra cows were brought to market, the supply of cows would increase. But if those extra cows were not brought to market, then the supply of cows would not increase. You see how that fits the thought pattern? All right? So there are all kinds of markets. Usually, a market is a physical place. It could be, some place in cyberland. We're in an area now where an era that it's really hard to define sometimes where the market is. For example, do y'all know what Second Life is on the internet? Anybody know? One person. Two people. Second Life. Well, just type in Second Life in Google and you go to it. But Second Life is a virtual world. Now, and it's free to enter, and what you do is you make yourself into a certain character, and then there's a currency in this world called lindens, and it takes so many lindens to equal $1. So you actually buy currency. And you can convert linens to dollars and dollars to currency. And then in this world, you can do anything that you can in the real world. You can buy real estate. You can sell real estate. There are universities that put on lectures. You can, there are rock bands available that give concerts in Second Life. Anything you can do in real life, you can do in this virtual world. In fact, there was a lady last year that made over $1 million in real money now, American dollars, in Second Life. Because she bought and sold property, and she got involved in different business ventures, and she made a lot of lindens, and she exchanged her lindens for dollars and ended up with over $1 million. Interesting, isn't it? Well, now here's an interesting idea, concept. In fact, I've got a friend whose daughter specializes in this in terms of law. She specializes in law that involves the virtual world. You go into Second Life and you buy real estate, or you enter into a business venture. But that person that you bought from cheated you in some way. Do you have legal recourse? Well, this is a section of law that is, in the process. I mean, this is such a new concept, but there have been some court cases where the judge has ruled, yes, this is, what you do in this virtual world, the same laws apply as would in real life. In other words, if you buy property in this virtual, now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about pixels on a screen, right? We're talking about electronic impulses. I mean, there is no real property there. It's just it's virtual. It's in an imaginary world. And yet, if you buy real estate and you're cheated, you can take legal action against that person in the real courts. Y'all find that interesting? Well, what got me talking about Second Life? Well, is that a market? I mean, if you go into Second Life and you buy and sell property, is that considered a market? Because the property doesn't exist in real life, so is it a real market? Well, the answer is yes, it is. Anyway, y'all ought to visit that world someday. It's really fascinating. You're on it now? Oh, looking at the website? Did you just put in Second Life in the Google or what? And it came right up. Yeah, cool. Cool. Mason, what you learn in economics, huh? So what is a product market? A product market is a market in which goods and services are exchanged. Now, a market in which goods and services are, that's the market that we are, mostly concerned with. As consumers, you go out and you buy and buy things at the store, and that's what is called the product market. But there is another market that's called the resource market. And the resource market are markets where resources are exchanged. Well, now, what are resources? Land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship, right? Now, remember, these are resources only when they are used in such a fashion that they are attempting to solve the economic problem, right? Remember I talked about how I've got a truck, but is that truck capital? Yeah. No, because I don't use it as capital. Of course, I ask you a question, and what's the answer? Well, that all depends. If I use my truck in a business sense to make a profit, it would be capital. But if I use my truck as simply for personal use, then it's not capital. Okay? So The resource market is when resources are bought and sold. Now, how are you involved on a daily basis in the resource market?
Labor,
exactly. Labor. See, when you have a job and you're getting paid, well, what market are you engaged in? What are you selling? You're selling your labor, and that is a part of the what? Resource market. Okay? Now, what does the term marginal mean? A term used to describe the result of a change in an economic variable. Now, this looks so innocent. But believe it or not, this is one of the most important principles that you'll learn in economics. The concept of the margin is highly important because we use this concept of the margin to explain how the world works. Now, let me give you an example, because sometimes it's impossible to convey an idea without a simple example. Let's suppose that you have money in your pocket, several dollars, and you are kind of thirsty, and you are standing in front of a soda pop machine. And the soda pops are a dollar. The price is a dollar. Question. Will you or will you not buy a soda pop?
No, it all depends.
Well, that all depends.
I don't drink pop.
Well, now, we're not talking about you personally. We're talking about, this would apply to you, but it applies to everybody. Will you or will you not buy a soda pop? Well, that all depends. If this, then that. But if that, then this, right? Okay, now, when will you buy a soda pop?
With a new water fountain.
Now, come on now. Here's a soda pop machine. Here, you've got dollars in your pocket. Let's just concentrate on one of those dollars, because the soda pop only costs $1. Now, there's again, I use the word cost, right? See how we can get into that. But anyway, here's a soda pop, and here's a dollar. You got a dollar in one hand, soda pop in the other hand. Are you going to buy a soda pop?
Put the dollar
in the machine. But are you going to do that, or are you not? It all depends on what?
I'm thirsty.
Well, people aren't specific than that. That's too general.
What kind of pop they have?
No, that's too general.
Oh.
I mean, we've got two things here. Now, what thought process? See, what I'm explaining to you is a thought process that you've engaged in since the very first day you were born. Every time you make a decision, you think this way. Still too general. Here's a dollar. Here's a soda pop. The question really is, which do you place a greater value on? Do you place a greater value on the dollar, or do you place a greater value on the soda pop? If you say to yourself, I would rather have a soda pop than a dollar, what will you do? Buy a soda pop. You'll put the dollar in the machine and you'll get a soda pop back. Now, by so doing, what happens to your level of satisfaction?
Nothing.
Goes up. Because you receive something of higher value in return for something of lower value to you. Right? And that's all what we're talking about here. We're talking about you in this exact situation. Now, in economics, what we would say is that you will buy that soda pop if your marginal utility is greater than the price. Now, what does the word margin mean? Well, margin means the last unit. And utility is a way of measuring a level of satisfaction. Now, if you ask me, well, how much is a util worth? I would say, I've got no idea. But I do know that 10 utils is 10 times one util. So I mean? I mean, we don't know how much a util was worth, but it's a way of measuring things. We know that 10 is 10 times 1, that 5 is 5 times 1. See what I mean? So if you're a marginal utility, now what does that mean? Well, that means how much satisfaction are you going to gain from that last unit? If your marginal utility is greater than the price, in this case a dollar, you will buy the soda pop. But if your marginal utility is less than the price, then you will not buy the soda pop. See, in that case, see, let's say you buy one soda pop, and then, you know, because your margin till is greater than price, and you buy a second soda pop, and your margin till is greater than price, and let's say you buy a third soda pop, and your margin till is greater than price, and then by the fourth soda pop, you're kind of bloated, and you're not thirsty anymore, and you're thinking, well, you know, should I buy a fourth soda pop? And then you say, well, you know, I would rather have this dollar here than a fourth soda pop. See, now your margin utility is less than the price. So you say to yourself, I'm not going to buy that fourth soda pop. So really, I've answered two questions here. First question was, with the first soda pop, will you buy the first soda pop? And the answer is, yes, you will, if margin... You see, well, first of all, you might say, well, that all depends. Yes, you will if marginal utility is greater than the price. No, you won't if marginal utility is less than the price. Now, another question is, how many soda pops are you going to buy to maximize your welfare? No, not quite, but you're on the right track. Now, all this is just very logical. The answer is, you will buy up to the last unit where margin utility is greater than the price. Mm-hmm. See, let's take the first soda pop. Yes, you'll buy it if your margin utility is greater than price. Second soda pop, yes, margin utility is greater than price. Third soda pop, yes, because margin utility is greater than price. Fourth soda pop, well, margin utility is less than the price. So you say, I don't buy the fourth soda pop. So how many soda pops did you end up buying? Three. Why three? Because the third soda pop was the last soda pop where your margin utility was greater than the price. Now, this whole thing I just went through is something that we talk about this is microeconomics, so this is really a big part of what we do this semester. Because remember, what does microeconomics entail? I mean, how does microeconomics differ than macroeconomics? Microeconomics entails what? It entails the decision making process of economics. What this semester is all about are tools that we learn to make better decisions. See, now that's basically what microeconomics is all about. What, you know, how do we understand the economy so that we can make better decisions? Now, what did I just explain to you here? You had a decision to make. Should you buy a soda pop or should you not? And if you bought a soda pop, how many soda pops would you buy? See, decisions. Now, what thought process did you go through to make that decision? Marginal analysis. You used marginal analysis to make the decision whereby you would maximize your welfare. See, from the first day you were born, because we live in a world of scarcity, we have to make choices. And every time we make a choice, every time we make a choice, we use marginal analysis. You know, you're first day born and you're lying in the crib, and the question is, you know, will you cry or will you not cry? And you'll cry if you think you're better off by crying, and you won't cry if you think you're better off not crying. Well, that's, I mean, first day you're born, you're making a decision based on marginal analysis. Now, of course, you don't think to yourself, hey, you know, should I cry or not cry? Now, let's see. Now, what, you know, which would I be better off? I mean, you know, you're not conscious of, you know, thinking this way. But really, you know, that's what you do, right? I mean, you've got choices here. And you, and every time you've ever made a choice, your thought process up in up here has used marginal analysis. And in terms of the soda pop, I just explained to you how you think. See, I didn't teach you anything new there. Now, again, you may not have known that you know that, or you may not be able to explain how you think in terms of making these decisions. But nonetheless, that's the way you think. So I've reached into your subconscious, and I've pulled out something that you already know. But now, you know it. Y'all find that interesting? You know, there's lots of examples of how we use marginal analysis. Let's say, and we are going to do a lot of this here in this semester. This is a good time to cover it, at least to introduce you to the concept. Let's say that you have you own a production company. And you want to know how many units to produce to maximize your profit. Decision, right? You got to make a decision here. Now, we use the same concept, it's marginal analysis, but we use slightly different terms because we're not talking about a consumer anymore. The terms we now use is marginal revenue and marginal cost. What's marginal revenue? Well, that's how much revenue you receive in the last unit. What's marginal cost? Well, that's how much the last unit costs you to produce. Now, in using so I might ask you a question. How many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit?
Well, that depends.
It depends on our thinking. Now, here's the point I was going to make. When you are presented with this situation, you see, I ask you a question, how many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit? You always begin at the beginning. Now I say, how many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit? But where is the beginning? Come on now, how many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit? But where do we begin to answer this question? And where's the beginning?
Zero.
Well, it could be zero or... Come on now, or...
No unit?
No. What's after zero?
One.
The beginning is the first unit, right? So now the question it boils down to... Will you produce the first unit or not? Now, what's the answer? But depends on what? Now, come on now. I just use the terminology. Come on now. It's the same thing as the soda pops, but it's just a different terminology. Will you produce that first unit? Well, let's say, yes, you will if... Come on now, what two things are going to...
Revenue and cost.
Revenue and cost.
So it's going to maximize your revenue.
Well, now we're not talking about maximizing yet, but we're just talking about will you produce that first unit or not. So, contrary to revenue and cost, exactly right. If marginal revenue is greater than marginal cost, now what does that mean? Well, that means how much revenue can you make on that unit and how much that last unit going to cost you to produce, correct? So if your marginal revenue is greater than your marginal cost, will you produce that first unit?
Yes.
Yes. Why? Because you're making money on that first unit, correct?
Yes.
All right, now what do? I want to know how many units produced to maximize my profit. So now what do? Well, what's the formula? It's actually it's a pattern. It's a thought pattern, really, more than a formula. But it's okay. We say okay, we're going to produce the first unit. Okay, now what's the second decision?
Second unit.
So we go to the second unit and we say, should we produce a second unit? And what's the answer?
If the marginal revenue is more than the marginal cost.
Then the answer is exactly right. Exactly right. If my MR is greater than MC, we'll produce that second unit. Okay, now what do? Let's suppose it is. Let's say that MR is greater than MC on the second unit. So now what do?
Third unit.
Same question. Is MR greater than MC? Now notice here, we're at the third unit. Does the first and second unit come into the picture? No, it doesn't. See, we're concentrating simply on that third unit, right? We're saying, okay, on this third unit, how much is my revenue and how much is my cost? I'm not talking about total revenue and total cost. I'm not talking about revenues and costs in previous units. I'm only talking about this third unit. See, that's what margin. See, margin always means the last unit. You've gotta, you know, consciously think the last unit, because that's what margin means, the last unit. So if MR is greater than MC, we say, okay, we'll produce the third unit. If MR is greater than MC in the fourth unit, we produce a fourth unit. If MR is greater than MC in the fifth unit, we produce the fifth unit. And then by the sixth unit, MR is less than MC. Now what do? We don't produce it. Why? Because we would be losing money on the last unit. Now, if we produce that last unit, could we be making a profit overall? Yeah, I mean, we could have made, you know, lots of money in the first five units, and we could produce the sixth unit and still made a good, healthy profit. But are we maximizing our profit? No, we're not, if we lost money on that sixth unit. See, I mean, it would have been better not to produce the sixth unit, right? Right? So the question is, don't answer this in terms of a number, but in terms of this thought process, how many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit? Well, essentially right. Yeah, I mean, that's one way of saying it. As long as MR is greater than MC, you'll continue producing additional units. That's essentially what you said, right?
Yeah.
Now, but what about that last unit that you produce? That last unit, see, how many, I want to know a number. I mean, you're right, I'll continue producing as long as MR is greater than MC, but how many am I going to produce?
One.
No, the answer is up until the last unit where MR is greater than MC. Now, see, you can underline the word last here. Last. I'll produce up until the last unit where MR is greater than MC. Because after that, on the next unit, MR would be less than MC, so I would not produce that last unit. See, I asked you a definite question. And again, this involves the decision-making process, right? This is what microeconomics is all about, the decision-making process of economics. How many, and notice here, I'm asking you a question, and I am answering this question definitively. I mean, this is an exact answer to a question. How many units are you going to produce to maximize your profit? Answer, up until the last unit where MR is greater than MC. See, that's a definite answer to a specific question. See how that works? I mean, let's say that you own a restaurant. It's a brand new restaurant. Let's suppose that this room is a restaurant, and each of the chairs here represents maybe a different table. And so, you know, we got so many square feet here, and we got so many tables. Question: how many waiters are you going to hire to maximize your profit? Well, now, where do you always begin? No, you begin where? At the beginning, which is the first one. So now the question really comes down to, will you or will you not hire the first waiter? Essentially right. But we changed the terms, but the concept is exactly the same. But here we're talking about wage and marginal product. Now, the concept is the same, but we just, you know, we're talking about wage. Now, what is marginal product? Marginal product is how much money will that last waiter bring into your establishment? I mean, what difference is it going to make to you in terms of your revenue by hiring that, you know, that one waiter? Now, will you hire the first waiter? The answer is yes, you will, if the marginal product is greater than the wage. In other words, if you pay this waiter, let's say, $100 a day, but this waiter brings in, let's say, $700 a day, will you hire the first waiter? Yeah, because he's bringing in more than what you're paying him. Marginal product is greater than the wage, okay? But I want to know how many waiters to hire to maximize my profit. So now what do? Go to the next waiter. Now the question is, should you hire a second waiter? And what's the answer? The what now over there? Give them a chance. All right, well, what two things are we looking at? I mean, how much it's costing me is the wage I have to pay the second waiter, but what do I compare that to?
How much
am I bringing in as a result of that second waiter, right? See, it's not how much money I'm bringing in total, it's how much money will that second waiter bring in over and above and beyond the first waiter. So if marginal product is greater than the wage, I'll hire that second waiter. And then what do I do? Well, now we go to the third waiter. We say, okay, again, now let's say that you pay this third waiter $100 a day, and this third waiter brings in, let's say, $100.02. Will you hire the third waiter? Yes. Why? Because you're making 2 cents. You're making money, right? And we're trying to discern here how many waiters to hire to maximize our profit. I mean, if you're making money, you're making money. It doesn't make any difference if you're making $700 or 2 cents. You're going to hire that waiter if you're making money, period. See? So on the third waiter, okay, marginal product. But now notice here that we're talking about a restaurant that has X number of tables and X number of square feet, correct? Now, it's obvious that when we start from zero, we're going to gain by hiring a first waiter, maybe a second waiter, maybe a third waiter. But, I mean, is that true ad infinitum? I mean, are we always going to gain by hiring more waiters? I mean, we're going to get to a point. We're going to get to some, you know, number here where that waiter will bring in less money than what we would have to pay him. And once that happens, we say, no, we're not going to hire that last waiter. So how many waiters do we hire to maximize our profit? Up until the last waiter where marginal product is greater than the wage. Now again, I ask you a question, and there's a definitive answer to the question, right? How many waiters? The last waiter where MR, where marginal product is greater than the wage. Now, see, what all I've been talking about here is the term margin. So it's because microeconomics involves the decision-making process of economics, and because to make decisions we use marginal analysis, then the concept of the margin is highly important. Now, you see why I've emphasized it? Now, on the first test, you're not going to be tested on what I just talked about, you know, MR and MC and how many units going to produce. But I mean, we've got chapters coming up here where we use that a lot, and you will be tested on it. But my purpose here was simply to introduce you to the concept. But in order to introduce you to the concept, I had to give you some examples. Okay, and so that's what I did. Okay, what is an economic model or theory? A simplified description of reality to understand and predict an economic event. Now, what we do in economics is that what we're attempting to do is understand what truth is. And we're trying to understand how the economy works. Now, first of all, how do you tell truth from untruth? If I say to you that it's snowing outside, you go look. If the sun is shining, I wasn't telling the truth. If indeed it is snowing, I was telling the truth, right? See, that's how you tell truth from untruth. You simply look out the window, essentially, right? Now, the reason why this is so important in economics, I mean, it's important to know what truth is that if we know truth and act on that truth, then there are rewards. But if we don't know the truth, or we know the truth but don't act on it, then there are penalties. Now, I can give you many, many examples, and we'll talk about many, many examples of this as we analyze, you know, how the world works here in an economic sense. But essentially, that's what economics is all about. See, in economics, we're truth seekers. I mean, what is truth? And why do we want to know that? Because we want to prosper. And we can only prosper if we know what truth is. And then we act on that truth. And the penalty for not knowing truth is poverty and misery. Or knowing truth but not acting on it. You see? So what we do in our attempts to understand what truth is, we try to draw pictures, or we try to come up with what are called models or theories. Now, this is how the world works. If A affects B this way, and then when A affects B, then that affects C this way, and see where we try to write down sort of these patterns and how we believe the world works. And essentially, that's what these economic models and theories are all about. Now, what is a variable? A variable is a measure such as a price or quantity that can take on different possible values. The word variable comes from the word vary. Vary is something that can change. It varies with the situation. That's what we call a variable. So let's when we're analyzing the economy, we recognize that some factors are variable and some factors are fixed, and we gotta know which things we're gonna fix, and which things are we gonna allow to vary. Now, in this, what is the other things constant assumption? The assumption when focusing on key economic variables remains unchanged. In other words, when we try to explain how the economy works, to simplify our analysis, we say, well, now, this is the way things would work if these things were fixed, and then these other things here maybe we could vary. Now, again, it's hard to understand this unless you're given an example. So let me give you an example. If the price of Cadillacs goes down by 30%, what will happen to the quantity demanded? If price goes down by 30%, what's going to happen to the number of units that people are going to want to buy? We would say that it would go up. Exactly. If the price goes down, then we would say people will buy more. Correct? Now, let's suppose at the same time the price of other luxury cars went down by 50%. Would people buy more Cadillacs because the price went down by 30%? Yeah, it all depends, but probably not, right? All right, or let me say this. The price of Cadillacs went down by 30%, but at the same time, the average person's income or incomes, let's say all incomes, went down by 60%. Now, will people buy more Cadillacs if their incomes went down by 60%? No, probably not. Okay? In other words, here's the point I'm making. If we can come to the conclusion that people will buy more if the price goes down, what do we have to assume? We have to assume that all other things remain constant. See, that's what this assumption here is. I mean, if we're going to come to a conclusion here and say that people buy more as the price goes down, we have to assume that other competing products are not changing in price. We have to assume that people's incomes don't change. We have to assume that tastes and preferences don't change. We have to assume that people's expectations don't change. You see what I mean? We have to assume a lot of things in order to come to a conclusion. But that's what we do in economics. In economics, you see, what we want to know is if A changes, how does A affect B? And if B changes, how does B affect C? Well, there are so many possibilities here that when we analyze this, we always make certain assumptions. And we say, okay, now, if this variable changes, assuming that everything else is fixed, what will the result be? And then we come to a conclusion. Now remember, economics is like playing a game. And like any game, there are rules to follow. And in economics, that this is one of those rules. One of those rules is, if something changes, we want to know what effect that change will have. But in analyzing the answer, we say, this thing can change, or this thing is a variable. Now, assuming everything else is fixed, then this will be the result. Like with these Cadillacs, if the price of Cadillacs goes down by 30%, and we assume that everything else remains constant, and nothing else changes here except for the price of Cadillacs, then we can say definitively, yes, people will buy more if the price goes down, and they'll buy less if the price goes up. You see how that works? But we couldn't come to that conclusion unless we recognize that... Now, what's the variable here? The variable is the price of Cadillacs. And what's fixed? Everything else. Things like those things I just described to you, the price of related goods and services and people's expectations and things like that. Okay, so that's something you got to know about economics. Now, what is the behavioral assumption? An assumption that describes the expected behavior of economic actors. Let's see. Yeah. The assumption that describes the expected behavior of economic actors. We assume... First of all, in economics, we're assuming that the economy is made up of economic persons. Now, what is an economic person? An economic person is a person who would rather have more than less. I mean, if I gave you a choice of a $100 bill or a $10 bill, everything else being equal, which would you choose? The $100 bill. See? Why? Because I'm assuming here that you would rather have more than less. Okay? So you know, we in our analysis of the economy and how, trying to come up with these our understanding of how the world works, We make certain assumptions, and we assume that people would rather have more and less. Now, that's not these things are not necessarily true 100% of the time, or at least not in the way that we're talking about. Like in economics, we assume that if the pay goes up on certain occupations, we assume that more people will want to have those jobs, right? I mean, if the pay goes up, for teachers, we assume that more people will go into the education field. If income, if the wage possibilities goes up for accountants, relative to all other wages, then we assume that more people will decide to become accountants. You see. So we assume that as the wage goes up, that people will want to engage in that activity. Well, I remember I've got a friend that has a construction business, and he had this employee, and the employee always reported to work 5 days a week, and he got real good at, he became more skilled, and. So my friend says, you're more valuable to me now because you've acquired all these skills and you're dependable, so I'm going to raise your pay. Well, just as soon as he did that, guess what happened? The guy started to come into work only 4 days a week. Why? Because he figured, well, if by raising my pay, I can pay my bills with what I can make in 4 days, so I'd better take off, Fridays and go fishing. See what I'm saying here is that we make certain assumptions, but do those assumptions hold true all of the time? Well, usually not. I mean, there are exceptions to these things, but we still make these assumptions. You see, I mean, we're still going to assume that if you pay people more money, that they'll have more incentive, to work. Okay. Okay, I got to get done. I got 5 minutes to get done with this chapter, and I think I can do it. What is the hypothesis? A statement about relationships among key variables. You know, we try to understand how certain things are related. Like, what is a positive economic statement? A statement that can be proved or disproved by reference to facts. A positive statement is, if the price of Cadillacs goes down, then the quantity demanded will go up. If the price goes down, people will buy more. That's a positive economic statement. Now, if I were to say, even though the price of Cadillacs goes down, that's a waste of resources, and people ought to spend their money on green cars, you know, fuel-efficient cars. Well, that would be a normative statement. Now, a normative statement involves a value judgment. You know, it is my opinion, okay? Now, in economics, especially this beginning course, we dwell on positive economics. See, it's not my role to give my opinion on certain things, but rather we concentrate on positive economics. Because what we're really interested in here is, how does the world work? What is truth? And, you know, people's opinions have bearing here. Now, quickly, what are some fallacies that we have to be careful of when we're analyzing how the world works? Well, there is the causation fallacy. This is the incorrect idea that if two variables are associated in time, one must necessarily cause the other. You were born in the country, on the farm. And when you were young, early in the morning, the rooster would crow. And when the rooster crowed, you looked up, and right away you saw the sun come up. So when you were young, you assumed that the rooster crowing caused the sun to come up. Now, does the rooster crowing cause the sun to come up? In other words, we might observe that one thing tends to follow another, but does that mean that the first caused the second? Well, maybe yes, and maybe no. I mean, we can't assume that the second was caused by the first offhand. I mean, it's like with the rooster crowing. I mean, just because you saw a pattern here doesn't mean that one factor caused the second. I mean, maybe it did, but you know, we can't assume it did. Say, what is the fallacy of composition? The incorrect belief that what is true for the individual or part must necessarily be true for the whole or group. You are in a football game, and there's an exciting... you're halfway up the bleachers, and there's an exciting play being... something exciting's happening. And so you stand up to get a better view. Where do we get a better view? Come on, you're halfway up the bleachers. Something exciting is going down. You stand up to get a better view. Will we get a better view? It all depends on what?
Somebody standing up.
Yeah, what other people do, right? If you're the only person that stands up, you'll get a better view. But if everyone stands up, you won't get a better view. See, what's true for one may not be true for the whole. Okay? And what are secondary effects? Unintended consequences of economic actions that develop slowly over time as people react to events. If we raise taxes, income taxes, will tax revenues for the government increase? Well, yes, maybe in a very short run, but what happens if we raise taxes and as a consequence, people work less? Or businesses hire fewer people because they got to pay them more in order to pay the higher taxes. In other words, things have secondary effects. Now, if we raise taxes, and as a consequence, people work less, businesses invest less, and the economic pie shrinks, then despite the higher taxes, what might happen to government revenues? They might go down instead of up. See? I mean, if we raise income taxes, maybe tax revenues for the government will go up, But maybe in time they'll go down. I mean, maybe. I'm not saying they will, but it depends on the circumstance, you see. And this is the end. So I did finish here at quarter two. And so this does end chapter one. Now, what are y'all going to do for next time? Read chapter two, right? So starting next time, I'll start with chapter two. So I'll see you all next time.